is tied up presenting a bill in another committee, and the minutes are passing by. So I think Mr. Salamone, and I don't know who's presenting exactly, but Revenue, why don't you come on down and get started? We've got Representative Bigham and the Republican lead, so we're ready to go.
The Republican lead? Oh, I was like, geez, maybe leaving.
Mr. Salamone, you have something to hand out?
Mr. Chair.
Not even our pages here, but we're going to get started anyway. You know the drill, so proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dan Salamone. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Appreciate the opportunity to come here and share with you information about our budget and answer any questions you may have. There's a handout coming around, and I'll just work through that. I don't have the PowerPoint projection here. I think we'll be fine. Mr. Chair, beyond the cover slide, you'll see the mission of the Department of Revenue, and many of you will have seen these slides before, and we've updated them. But our mission hasn't changed. Our mission is to make sure that the revenue system works well for Minnesotans. And our vision is that everyone pays the right amount of tax, no more, no less. So we think that's, you wouldn't believe how much time we spent working on the strategic plan to come up with what looks like a fairly simple statement, but there was a lot of discussion around that. We like to think about the compliance cycle of revenue being much more holistic than we normally think of tax collections. If you look at the top of page 2, there is a reminder that administering the tax structure of the state of Minnesota involves informing taxpayers of their obligations, providing service to taxpayers so they can file their taxes properly. Obviously, we have to process returns as they come in. We have to audit returns to make sure that they are correct. And we have to enforce taxes when taxpayers are not in compliance. We also have on that cycle of recommendation sort of a feedback loop to bring back to committee here, tax committee and other committees, recommendations for improvement in the tax structure of the state. And there's data on the bottom of page 2 on the numbers of taxpayers. Gives you a sense of the magnitude of the task that we have. The 3.6 million taxpayers, 165,000 withholding taxpayers. I won't read all the numbers there. They speak for themselves. Top of page 3, a little more in statistics on our work. We provide forms and instructions to over 4 million taxpayers. We process over 9.2 million filing and payment transactions. We answer 635,000 phone calls. We conduct over 115,800 audits and assess appropriately approximately 400 million. We collect approximately 550 million from compliance efforts, and we respond to 38,000 email inquiries. On the bottom of page 3, it's important to note that the department, with the advent of compliance initiatives, we sort of bifurcated the department into direct compliance activities. These are frontline auditors and collectors, revenue examiners, and then we have the back of the house, the compliance support, which would consist of HR functions, the commissioner's office, communications, financial management, human information systems, and our tax operations department, which is the filing and paying of returns. And of course, we have, as you well know, a very robust tax research department in our agency. It's important to note that the direct compliance activities, these frontline activities, comprise now two-thirds of the department's resources and budget.
Mr. Sal, let me just interrupt you for a second. We have a quorum, so the committee is in session. And Mr. Caff is going to move the minutes.
So moved.
Discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Minutes are approved. Mr. Salamone, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have the department sort of broken down into direct compliance and compliance support. The former, direct compliance is two-thirds of our budget. Compliance support is one-third. I always like to make it clear, though, that every employee of the Department of Revenue has, indirectly at least, a role in helping with the tax compliance. So it's a continuum. But it's important to note that on the next slide, a little bit of history that is a result of our compliance initiatives over the years. If you look at page 4, top of page 4, compliance support in the years 2000-2001 comprised 52% of the agency. And now in 2010-11, compliance support comprises only 33% of the agency's resources. So we've had quite a shift away from support toward direct compliance activities. And I'm not saying that that's inappropriate. It was sort of a direct result of funding compliance initiatives. When we get compliance initiative dollars, as we have for several years, from the legislature, we invest those dollars in direct compliance activities. We generally don't have the luxury of using those monies for some of the backroom functions of the agency. And so I think that explains why over time we've had a growing imbalance between the two sides of the agency. And the imbalance maybe is not inappropriate, given where we're at. But eventually, if you're making a cake, you have eggs and milk and flour. You have your various inputs or ingredients. And if they get too far out of a line, you know, the cake doesn't taste quite as good as it might otherwise. So we think there is something to the idea of having proper proportions between support and direct compliance. I don't know what that is, but we'd start to work on it incrementally.
Mr. Salamone, I have a question. Do you think it's possible that if, as part of a tax compliance initiative, we actually allowed you to include employees in compliance support, you could still deliver the same kind of return ratios that we have talked about? Another way of saying is, do you still have the soft side staffing you need in order to actually support the compliance initiatives that we continue to request?
Mr. Chair, I think to the extent that we have that freedom, if we were able to fund more of the support side, I suspect there'd be a little bit of a noticeable reduction in the ROI from the direct compliance activity. It's a balancing act. I think that we're still sort of groping to get the right ratio. Maybe Dan, if you have anything to add to that answer.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dan Ostick with the Department of Revenue. I think in the past there has been a little bit on the soft side for areas that we need, such as our HRM or something like that, where we're bringing in a lot of people. It's been very minute. I think we're at a level right now where I think we can meet the ROI that's been discussed in the proposed initiative. But it's very difficult. Some of the things we've run into is really space issues with the department. That's been the most difficult piece right now. So we always count space issues as soft dollars for us. So we might have to rent some area, some square footage.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the question I have in regards to that, you run into space. I think there are some technology tools, software, that instead of adding more FTEs, instead look at some of those tools that would maybe help filter, refine, ease some of that. Is that being considered, or some other areas you would like to address there or need?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kipmeyer, we're sort of, we love technology and revenue. We, our folks are very, you know, quick to embrace new technologies, and over the years we've been able to use it to the benefit of the agency and the state. I think we're much more productive than we were years ago. So if there's some new technology out there that we're not using, we certainly would want to know about it and take advantage of it. So, as you know, we're in the middle of deploying a new tax processing system that you all helped fund, and that's going to have great payoff when that's fully matured, and it's going along very nicely. I'll have some more comments about that later.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salamone, in relation to Representative Kiffmeyer's question, I did introduce a bill that would have the Department of Revenue put out an RFP for business intelligence tools, specifically tax analytics, as other states have done with great success. And Massachusetts, New Mexico, South Carolina, I believe Wisconsin did a pilot program recently. And just wanted to know if you were familiar with that, and what these other states have found is that they were able to do a lot more with fewer staff because they were able to zero in on good audit candidates without, you know, harassing
Sure.
tax-paying citizens. And I just was wondering if you, I know that there was a pilot program with the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure where that's at. And I guess I just wanted you to comment on that and if you'd be open to such a proposal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, we certainly would be open to looking at that RFP or that proposal. We don't want to miss any opportunities to improve on what we're doing. We have, as you noted, we have been working with the University of Minnesota to do data mining and data warehousing. We have a lot of data, and the more data that we have and the more we can access that data in an efficient way, the better we can administer the tax system. Certainly the better it would be for compliance, to be able to get the reconnaissance you need to find taxpayers who are not compliant. So I think we'd certainly be interested in looking at what you're proposing. Greg Cheetah, if he's not here, he's right behind me. He's our resident expert in data mining and data warehousing, who could fill you in on where we're at.
Is there another? You want to respond as well?
Looks like.
I just have
Representative Pepin.
To interject here, I just I don't know if the pages got a chance to pass this out to you or anybody on your team. I have just some information on my bill and what some of the other states have done. And
My name's Greg Cheatham. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm very familiar with Massachusetts, Texas. Talk to Wisconsin all the time. So, but if you want to pass it around or want me to speak to some of those, I can do that as well. This is something that Department of Revenue has been doing for quite a while. We were one of the first ones, states, to ever have a data warehouse. In the last 5 years, we have thrown a lot of effort into data warehousing. And as you mentioned, we did do a number of pilots with the University of Minnesota. Professor Jadeep Srivastava, I call him Jadeep all the time. and it was very successful with the students, and it was something that was showing some a whole lot of promise. As a matter of fact, we won a very prestigious award, and I somehow got to be a co-author on it. I'm not exactly sure how, because they weren't supposed to publish anything. But on our data mining efforts, it is something that, as Deputy Salamone was saying, we are very, very interested in doing. Unfortunately, because of the integrated tax system, our databases are changing. We no sooner got all of our data onto a DB2 database that now all of a sudden we have new data from the integrated tax system that we're putting in. And it is now on a SQL Server database, and there's different fields in the rest, and we're trying to consolidate all this so that we can get back to doing a number of things like exactly as you're saying. The problem is, you know, a couple of the biggest tax types, individual being one, won't even be in production until December of this year. So timing is really where we're at right now, where we really need to get the integrated tax system up. We need to get our data, you know, together in one spot, very consistent, and then we really, really want to hit more on taking a look at the data mining aspects and the predictive modeling. A number of states have as Representative Pepin has said, have had very great success. New York, working with IBM, has done some amazing things right during processing, where they've been able to get phenomenal returns and things. And it's things that, as I said, we have looked at. Some of our pilots were very successful, some of them not so much, and we really were learning a lot. And as I said, it's something that we are very interested in pursuing as soon as we get the integrated PAC system.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's great. I'm glad you're happy to pursue this. I was just curious about the pilot projects. What did they stop? Are they continuing? Why would they?
We pretty much had to stop because of the integrated PAC system, because there's really three major aspects that you have to be successful in data mining and the experience that we came up with. The first is you really have to have good data. You've got to clean up your data. You've got to have it there so that it can work with each other. And you need a lot more data than just from like revenue and the rest. I mean, some of the things that we were looking at were like lifestyle audits, where we'd take income information and geographical information and household information and stuff from the DNR and how many boats you had and from public safety about what cars that you drove. And then you could do where it would actually, these algorithms that the students, using some very specific tools, some of actually the best ones are open source, churn through and actually come up with anomalies that said, okay, you know, why is this person, you know, for the last 3 years lost $10,000, yet he's just purchased 2 Mercedes and he got a boat and a cabin on Lake Minnetonka, or a home on Lake Minnetonka and things. So it alerts you to who you might want to take a look at some of these pieces and the rest. But bringing all this data together and the rest is not as easy as it sounds. So that's the first piece. The second piece is you really have to tap your audit staff, because they have the institutional knowledge of what's good and the rest, and it takes a lot of time, and you really want, I hate to use this phrase, your best and your brightest. Because if you can tap into them and build that knowledge into the algorithms, you really are benefiting yourself. The third piece is the statistical knowledge and the sampling that the University of Minnesota students and the professor can bring to the table. And so you really need all three pieces. Unfortunately, the first two pieces are stretched right now because of the integrated PAC systems and, quite frankly, the compliance initiatives. When we bring new auditors on, we train them with our good people. And so we have to have that balance of taking our good auditors and train our beginning auditors, and then also you just want to bring in the dollars to get the initiative done, and then to complicate it by taking some of those really good ones and then put them onto something like this at this point, then it just stretches the talent pool a little bit too much.
Thank you. Let us know what we can do to help.
Okay.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would say, in regards to this, it would be really great. I think we've got a lot of bright people at the University of Minnesota. And when I hear mention of some of those things, I also think about, there's other companies, other things, that sometimes the cost effectiveness, speed, and some of those things are a factor there. But just as a comment, when I hear some of these things, it makes you wonder about just doing away with the income tax and just having a more sales tax thing. And I hear all the costs and all these other things going on, and possible privacy issues of what people are doing with their money and all of that. Maybe we will think about that in the future as well.
Representative Kipmeyer, I think most people are more concerned about the privacy of what they're buying than where they're earning their money.
Right.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the level of effort that it takes to put in an agency-wide system like what you're doing with integrated tax. I also know I worked a little bit with Representative Pepin and read her bill, and I know one of the components of it was that we wouldn't go through a typical procurement and actually buy the software and install it and you have to do that, I get that, but there are companies that are doing this on more of a success fee type of an arrangement. And so I guess the question, or maybe even the challenge, is why wouldn't we start some of that? And I appreciate you want to get your data model kind of tightly buttoned down, and you got to have some people to do these things, but the whole purpose of this is to actually start having these analytic pieces of software starting to listen to the transactions and see where the the compliance issues are and draw correlations and start to do the prediction building and kind of the artificial intelligence pieces of it, why wouldn't we start? At least doing the front-end analysis and maybe whatever procurement activities need to go on. It seems to me that could be going in parallel with you finishing up the project, so you don't then start this at the end of your current project and then have 2 years before you even really get to it.
Mr. Cheetah?
Underlying all of this, unfortunately, as I said, is the data. And right now, particularly, we have data in two places, is pretty much what it is. And the data for income tax, the way it's stored currently, is going to be different come December. The data that we have for sales tax for the last number of years, it's in a DB2 warehouse. We're in the process right now of our tool is called GenTax, that's the application, GenTaxifying it so that it can be used by the GenTax thing. Your point is well taken, but the data is really the underlying piece, and until you really have the data, it's really tough to even start looking at tool selections and the rest. It does continually change. There are a number of vendors out there. Teradata is a big data mining piece that want to do it. SAS Institute does a whole lot of things. That's what's happening in Wisconsin. RSI uses them quite a bit. They're the ones who are out in New Mexico. And working with the people that I know, and I, as I said, I have contacts in most of the states that you mentioned, Representative Pepin, they say get your data right first. Otherwise, you're just going to be spinning your wheels. So I guess I'm going off of their experiences at this point. We have not tried to do a business intelligent tool selection at this point in time. I guess it is something we could look at it, but it's kind of jumping the gun in what people have been telling me.
Representative Downey?
Again, I'll make a final comment and you can reply, but I'd like to push us in maybe an offline meeting. Unfortunately, you're talking to an old systems management consultant guy who did a lot of these things, and oftentimes the way you build your data model in part should be driven by the kind of analytics and the reporting that you want to do downstream. So
absolutely,
we could in fact be cementing a data model and business processes and practices that require lots of people and lots of manual processes that then you got to unwind on the back end when you put these things in. So anyway, just a challenge to maybe be receptive to another conversation or two to see whether there's a way to pull this off without totally having you guys lose all your hair and
I would put huge bags
under your eyes. So thank
you. I'd love to show you what we're doing and what we have and let you sit down and talk to our data architects and because we are exactly on the same page as where we want to get to. It's something that, as I said, we were a little disappointed that we had to kind of put things on hold. It wasn't really something that we wanted to do. It's just something that people told us you'd be better off if you did do it. So, okay.
Mr. Cheetah, I guess I have a follow-up to that, which is that if the committee and the legislature were willing to accept some marginally lower ROI on the tax compliance initiative, whether an additional project along the lines of what Representative Downey and Pepin have talked about is something that some funding might help as well. If it's a consultant to come in to help identify the data model to best use the tools that might be available down the line or something like that.
I believe the Department of Revenue has made a substantial commitment, and as I said, we are actually in the process of doing that right now. The issue that we have is, I'm going to take income tax as our example, we don't have any idea right now what our income tax data is going to look like come December, because at this point in the project they don't know. Now we do know the data elements that are typically on the M1 return and the rest, but how it's going to look and how they're going to store it in their transaction systems and how and get it out and how to match it with the previous 7 years worth of data that we have on income tax, those are the issues that we're working right now, and it's partly time that we have to deal with. As I said, the department, I think Dan mentioned, the department has, I think, invested in this and sees the value in it, and I'm not sure additional funding at this point in time will make it go any faster.
Continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Bottom of page 4 shows our staffing over time from 1996 to 2009. If you'll note that as of 2009, or at least for the fiscal year 2009, we had staffing of 1,422. You notice it has kind of a slight U-shape in the pattern of the bars. The early years reflect the drop in funding, FTEs as a result of our movement into more IT applications, and in particular the e-file has had a profound effect on our department. In the latter years, you see the ramping up of the compliance initiatives. That is the single most important factor in the rise of our complement from about 2002 through 2009 and 2010. So this shows clearly the effect of compliance initiatives on the FTE. Not a surprise there. On the top of page 5 is a slide showing our budget for 10 and 11. And I guess the only noteworthy thing there is that we are 96.8% general fund funded agency. So we are obviously very dependent on general funds. It shows that we have a few other pieces there that we administer: the health care access fund, the highway user tax, and the environmental fund. The bottom of that chart is a list of challenges. I think you may have seen some of these in the past. I'll run through them very quickly. The first one is a complete it is a challenge for us to be installing a new integrated tax system while running the old system. And so that's really quite a challenge. It's going well so far, but it's one of those things you continue to worry about. The second one is the loss of institutional knowledge. I'm sure you've heard this from many other people who have come up here from the agencies. We are going to lose a lot of key people in the agencies in the next 5 years. We did some workforce planning a couple of years ago, and it looked like we would be losing about 20% of our key people in the next 5 years. So we have to groom people to be ready to take those positions, and that will be a challenge. We have a growing percentage of younger people in the department. That's a good thing, I suppose, speaking as an older person. And that's, a result of the compliance initiative. We get a compliance initiative, we're by and large hiring younger people coming in. They're less experienced employees, so we have a challenge to bring the training to them. And so if you look at the age distribution of the revenue department, it's almost like a U-shape, another U-shape, where you have a whole bunch of young people and a whole bunch of older people, and you have that middle where you have a lot of inexperienced people. Our auditors nowadays need more systems training than ever for the complex audits. The training is a greater challenge than it used to be. We have a more diverse set of taxpayers and employees, and it's a challenge for us to deal with the language differences, but it's also a good thing to have that the enrichment that they bring to the workplace. We've done a lot of work in translating our materials into Spanish. But when it comes to other languages, we generally have to revert to our phone line and have a person available to talk to that taxpayer who understands the language. So that's a challenge. Monitoring appropriate employee access to data and systems. I don't have to tell anyone here about the importance of that and the new emphasis that the OLA has asked us to look at. So we have to deploy more resources to make sure that people have only the access that they need to have for our data. And I'm talking about our employees. We have had to go through a lot of training for internal controls, financial code of conduct, and training on incompatible duties. That was a mandate from MMB, and we had to train 1,173 of our employees, which is the bulk of them, if you remember the staffing level, to be knowledgeable of that and have them to sort of certify that they understand the policy. Finally, there used to be a time when we had a lot of vacant space in the Stassen building. We now have no vacant space in the Stassen building. The last big move we made was to bring in the Office of Administrative Hearings into our building, and that has been a good thing. It's worked well. We're sharing a lot of services within the department with the OAH, but we are clearly now at a point where we're beginning to talk about hoteling. Hoteling is where you put two people into a cubicle, and that may not necessarily be the best thing to do, depending on the characters that you're putting in the cubicle. So that's a challenge for us. We have lots of challenges. We also have had the challenge historically of auditor, a fast turnover in our auditing area. And that has lessened a little with the economy, but it's still a concern to us.
Mr. Chair, can you talk about that a little bit more in detail about the turnover, what you're looking at, what you're dealing with?
Historically, we, of course, have been hiring a lot of auditors as part of the compliance initiatives. We bring them in, we train them. It takes a year or two to train them, get them up to a high level of proficiency. And then because at least several years ago, the demand for accountants was very strong in the market. And so about the time we were finished training them, they would get an offer, sometimes some multiple of the salary that they're making at the revenue department, and it would leave us. So we were basically running a school for auditors for the private sector. That now, as I said, is we're getting some relief, but we still, as of fiscal year 2008, the turnover rate was 36%. Within about a year or two, you'd lose 36% of your new hires. I suspect, depending on what happens to the economy, that problem could come back. I expect it to come back once we have a decent recovery. Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thanks. Just a couple questions for whoever wants to answer it. First of all, disclaimer, I used to work at that building, the Stassen building. I was with the AG's office and was in the tax litigation division back when we were housed in that building. In fact, I moved into that building from the older location across the river. But anyway, one of the things that I remember when I was there and that was a concern once in a while, fortunately not a lot, but I think it's still a concern to some people when we talk about compliance, is this whole idea of making sure that we don't have folks who are overzealous, who are, you know, hounding regular citizens who are trying to do the right thing. What can you give us a little comfort about to what extent the training focuses on that aspect, not just the technical aspect of the job, but that kind of balance between wanting to seek out revenue but making sure that we're not unleashing legions of Department of Revenue people on the unsuspecting and the innocent, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, we acknowledge that our training historically has been on the technical aspects of the job, how to do an audit right, and less so on the sort of soft side of auditing, the bedside manners and so on. And I think recently we've heard more about that in the agency, and we are resolved to try to do something to improve in that area so that not only are taxpayers technically competent, but they also have some training in how to deal with people. We also know that we have to look more carefully at coordinating audits so that we're not going to the same business, you know, for each individual tax in a short period of time. So that's definitely on our radar screen, and we're having internal conversations about it. I can't tell you at this point that we have a plan to deal with that, but we're definitely talking about it. And the Commissioner Innes is very aware of that.
Is there a further comment?
Mr. Chair, my name is Terry Steenblack, and I'm the Director of the Collection Division. One of the things I can tell you that we do is we have a quality assurance program in place, and one of the things that we do, it's a two-pronged approach. So we record and listen to their phone calls that are with the citizens and provide them with feedbacks on those particular calls. That is also incorporated into the overall performance review of those individuals. In addition to that, we also have a quality assurance program where we review audits and we review collection cases to make sure the appropriate actions have been taken and that we haven't stepped outside of those boundaries. In situations where we may have some occurrences where somebody has done something that does not align with our procedures, we do contact the taxpayer and make the situation right with them. And we also coach the individual employees, and that is incorporated into their performance as well. So we're continuously looking at that and evaluating the work of both the collectors and the auditors.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I remember when I was representing the department, there used to be an office there called a taxpayer advocate. Is that still there?
Yes.
And what, if any, function does that person or does that office serve with respect to these audit activities?
Ms. Dima.
Mr. Chair, members, the taxpayer rights advocate, citizens have access to that office at any time should they have an issue or a concern. They as well have a phone line and or people can write to them. At any time, the taxpayer rights advocate, when they get involved, we typically cease all actions until they've had an opportunity to review the particular case and make suggestions. Sometimes they will overturn the actions that have been conducted by either the auditor or the collector, and we are required then to make adjustments to the process. And again, the employees are coached back. But the advocate's office is really considered an independent body within the agency.
Mr. Salmon, I'd just like to return to this issue of turnover. So you said in 2008 the turnover rate of the, was it the auditors or the new auditors, was 36%?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's auditors as opposed to collectors. The problem has been in the auditor class.
And Mr. Salamone, and that number is now down from the 36% because of the economy. Do you have any sense of
the old, Mr. Chair, the 07 number was 40.3, and I don't have data for the earlier years. I should also mention that in the earlier years, we had a memo of understanding with the Department of Employee Relations to give them a more rapid acceleration through the pay scale in their early years, because we noticed we were losing them after a year or two. That MOU has now expired, has been expired for, I think, probably over a year. And I think we need to take a look at trying to get something reestablished for those new hires.
And Mr. Salamone, is the MOU expired in part in recognition of budget challenges? Is that why there hasn't been the...
Mr. Chair, I believe that's the reason. I there were some issues with regard to employees who didn't fit that classification, auditing folks who were not in that frankly, I'd have to go back and look at what some of the reasons were, but it had expired, and we need to take a look at getting that resurrected.
Mr. Salamone, I guess my final point or question is, you know, we're providing these auditors, the CPAs, with some apparently quite valuable education, training, and experience, and oftentimes if you get additional education paid for by your employer, there's kind of a clawback included that you have to maintain a certain number of years of employment or you have to pay some of it back. Is there a way to quantify or to in some way, for the sake, you know, in exchange for the great training they apparently get, ask them that they to serve longer?
Mr. Chair, there might be a way to set that up. I'm not sure how mechanically how we would do that, but I know there are instances where that happens in companies and other settings. So that's something we could certainly look at to try to at least have that as a tool to keep them from jumping off the reservation early.
Well,
take a look at that.
Mr. Salamone, I guess I won't think of the Department of Revenue quite that way, but obviously, if you give them an incentive by moving up the pay grade or the pay scale faster, that's one way, but also putting them on the hook for the quality of education. I mean, you know, granted, you're probably providing a valuable service to the accountant community out there, and it probably helps the economy overall, but it might be just something for you to look at and consider.
I agree.
Representative Kipmeyer.
Yes, that is a really good point. And by the way, this also affects IT departments as well. Certain of these areas where they get a tremendous background in education. But is there anything in state law, or is there anything that would, you know, when you are investing a significant amount of time and effort in training folks, is there anything in HR or whatever that would allow that they at least give us some portion of return from the training?
Representative Kiffmeyer, I guess that's directed.
It looked like
Shepard, and you know, yes. Even though he doesn't deserve it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I don't know of anything in state law that addresses that directly. I think at some point that topic would intersect with some of the terms and conditions of employment that are negotiated in union contracts, since those contracts and personnel plans establish compensation. It might be necessary to have something in law that would either authorize or require something like that, or it would have to be negotiated.
Commissioner Reines, do you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Reines with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And regarding this idea of a clawback or handcuffs, what do you want to call it?
We don't want to call it that.
You know, one thing that's extremely important, it's come up in discussion both in this committee and in the Senate, in your Senate counterpart committee, is about the training, the importance of training for auditors and collectors before you put them out in the field, before they interface with taxpayers. And we put a high premium on the training element of this. And as you know, we've been on a lot of challenges with the compliance initiatives. We've all talked at length about the challenges associated with the compliance initiative. But through these challenging times, we have never short-shrifted or short-changed the training element within our agency. And we've tried other ways to mitigate turnover, mitigate loss of jobs. And Commissioner Salmoy has talked about the MOE. And it's my understanding, so for a point of clarification, that the MOE is still in place. It has been temporarily sustained because we have hiring freezes, we have pay increase freezes effective across all categories of state government. It does expire on July 1st, and we have traditionally gone back and asked for an extension if we had challenges as far as retention. MMB has been very helpful in that regard. They've extended it at a year at a time in order to maintain our auditors to the best of our ability. It has brought up some issues as far as equity among even auditors. So you have senior auditors who have been there prior to the enactment of the MOE. And so you've gotten some salary compression where you even have junior auditors who have been there a shorter period of time that actually are making the same or more than more senior auditors. So we're trying to think of a way, if we extend the MOE again as the economy turns around, we still have challenges on retention, of mitigating that inequity within the agency. And we've done other things in the past to try to keep our employees happy, keep them in the fold and not looking around to go to the CPA firms. Some of those things we've had to suspend during this difficult economic times. For example, we've had probably what I think is maybe the most generous tuition reimbursement program in state government. Reimbursing, I believe it was up to $5,000 per year for training above and beyond your basic training at the department. So if you wanted to get an MBA or you wanted to get an MMA in taxation or something, we would pick up $5 of the tab on an annual basis. It was a great way of incenting younger employees to stay around and work on their MBA and get a CPA. We've had to suspend that, mothball that currently. That's one of the first things we want to bring back when the economy turns around, the budget challenges aren't so great. But I think if you look, we've had a challenge in the audit area, but if you look across the whole spectrum of the state of employees within the Department of Revenue, we do a pretty good job of retaining our employees. You know, I think it's a function of there's work balance. We have some pretty good fringe benefits. We had the tuition reimbursement, which I think was very helpful with younger employees. But it is an ongoing challenge. I would be reticent about doing something, saying, having some kind of clawback in place for what is really your basic training element of employees. You know, that's the basic training. That's for those employees to do their job well and do it efficiently. To have some kind of clawback or some kind of, I think would be, I think that'd be problematic. And I think you're right. I think it's something that probably has to be negotiated via the union contract.
Representative Kiffmeyer, I just want to just jump in quickly and just ask whether, I mean, if 36% turnover is better, and 40% is what you used to have, it just seems to me extraordinarily high and something that should be a significant concern to the department, even if in other areas, it goes pretty well. And I guess if tax compliance is what's driving that, I for one would be interested in hearing proposals on how we might be able to reduce the ROI ratio on the compliance by some amount in order to ensure that we don't have that kind of turnover in place. So, right. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would say, Commissioner, that my intention in bringing up that subject really didn't have to do with basic training to do a job they were hired to do. Not at all. I think what we find sometimes is more the tuition reimbursement when they go on to do something that an MBA is not a condition of being an employee. That is something that enhances their personal value, and it goes beyond that. If then they are being given that, there would be an expectation that I think would be reasonable and fair. And I had experience with this where we would invest in people and they would do some of those things that were being very nice, and next thing you know, no longer did they get their certificate, then they were gone. And so it almost like it actually hurt us in that regard. So I think my goal is more focused not on the basic training to do their job, but those extra add-ons and making sure that there is a value return. We understand that sometimes that they put the extra effort in, and it certainly is that. But it's mostly that we also get some benefit, too, for that investment.
And Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, I couldn't agree more. In fact, for our tuition reimbursement, we did in fact, have a clawback. There was a clawback, a partial clawback of any tuition reimbursement if you left within a certain time frame. And we have exercised that clawback on a number of occasions. We have another way. Use the stick is the clawback. The carrot also is if you got your CPA and you stuck around for a certain amount of time beyond after receiving that CPA, you got an additional bump, a one-time bonus payment. So we try to, once they got the CPA, a lot of times the CPA's firms, come in and try to lure them away. We try to do a little bit of a carrot approach as well. We'll pay for you to get your CPA, but you got to stick around a little while, and we'll give you another spiff as a bonus to try to help retention. So we have had the clawback in place for that tuition reimbursement, because we agree with you, Representative. It's more of a fringe. It goes above and beyond the basic training requirements that are necessary to do the job.
I continue. I guess bottom line, for my interest anyway, is I'd be curious to hear some ideas for trying to reduce that level of turnover.
Yeah. And Chairman, we would entertain any and all ideas. We've talked about this at length within the senior management team over there. One of the issues we have, even with the MOE, is that MMB has been very helpful in getting this MOE in place. There's been pushback from other state agencies. Says we have auditors as well. Why don't we get access to this MOE and additional pay spiffs above and beyond the union contract? So we've tried to keep it as focused as possible, but other agencies, legislative auditor and others have said, hey, why can't we get a comparable agreement, MOE? So there's challenges to, we have our own trial and challenges. I think every agency has their unique challenges.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with your observation that we should do whatever we can to reduce the turnaround. I thought the bad economy would take care of that for us. But if it's not, I guess I'm interested in, do you do exit interviews when people are leaving? Are you getting any kind of answer as to why they're leaving and what the reasons are?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, right now, and no surprise to anybody sitting around this table, but there is not a turnover problem, retention problem currently at the department.
Okay.
Our expectation is, and I think Mr. Finito would probably second this, is that once the economy turns around, there's probably a pent-up demand for this within the CPA firms, and that they'll probably do a pretty heavy job of lobbying some of our people once the economy turns around. But right now, that's not a reason why we could suspend the MOE during this time, because we were not seeing the attrition and the retention issue. We saw when we did hiring fairs associated with the compliance initiatives that the quality of candidates we were getting was superior to anything we've gotten in previous job fairs, both for our collectors and for our auditors. So the marketplace certainly right now is feeling the pressure, and in some perverse way, we were the beneficiaries of a bad labor market, because we got the pick of the litter of very, very high quality applicants. But right now, Madam Chair, to be clear, there is not a retention problem, but we know on the horizon there probably is going to be one.
Well, hold on to those people. Yeah. Representative Kahn. Well,
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest, as you see this coming, which is supposedly good news that we would be looking for, that you also put in place an exit interview process so that you find out, is it just that we can't match private salaries, or is there some issue on working conditions and so forth. Yeah. One of the things one of the things I've said, some of the things that I've tried to do, and I know that you're trying to do some of these things, to which are the kinds of things that would be important to people I know in whether they want to stay in a job or move to another job, is the ability to do telecommuting, the ability to work flex time, the ability to set their own hours. All of those things would be highly beneficial, and I know you're doing some of those things, and I'm sorry I was late to the meeting. I was trying to cure cancer in another committee, but unsuccessfully, I'm going down. But you know, I wonder if you think you've done it, gone as far as you can in that, or is there directions to go further on those issues and so forth, or if you've even found out if the people I know who would really like that aren't the kinds of people who become CPAs and tax auditors. So,
Chairman, Representative Kahn, I don't know if Commissioner Salmon has touched on our telecommuting policy, but it is, as you say, Representative Kahn, extensively utilized throughout the agency and all divisions. In fact, we recently implemented a new telecommuting policy that's to make it uniform across all divisions, because some divisions were exercising more liberally than other divisions were. So we wanted to have a uniform policy, because we understand that is a quality of life issue. For many folks, it works very well. You know, collectors, field auditors, and those folks to be able to telecommute and save time and, you know, in that area. So that's certainly something we've utilized fairly extensively. But, you know, it's not as simple as just saying, okay, you can telecommute, we're going to give you a laptop and go home. There's disclosure issues and security issues. Every place that is designated a telecommuting venue has to be checked out for, make sure all the disclosure and security issues are taken care of. All the software has to be encrypted, you know, cable locks and all the equipment. There's got to be a place on the premises that is separate from where other people may, you know, have easy access to. So it's quite a protocol we need to go through before we can designate every person a telecommuter. But a large portion of our employees have either full or 100% telecommuting pretty much, or on a limited basis upon whenever it's convenient for them.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, then I guess I have a separate request to you, for you, which is one of the things we're trying to do is to have more of this done where appropriate in state government. And if your department has been the pioneer on this, and if you're getting all kinds of information as to what the problems are, we'd like to have that information about what worked, what didn't work, whether it was a good idea, you know, what you felt the cost savings were attendant to it, what you thought, if there weren't any, you know, if it, other than not needing to put new desks in place or something like that. So we'd like you, give you something else to do without giving you anything more money to do it with. We'd like you to be able to help, as that discussion becomes more complete throughout state government, we'd like to hope that you can give us some real numbers and some real useful information on it.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions that I'd have for the commissioner, and then just sort of looking a little bit deeper, you mentioned the term quality of life, and for retention, I know that especially for our professional employees across many departments, it's sort of stability and wanting to be able to do their work and be respected and sort of, you know, feel like they're doing the professional work that they've been trained and want to do it with their careers. A question that I have for you all is a sort of a mirror back on us as well, thinking about what's happened at MnDOT and we saw a little bit of attrition of some very qualified engineers, and we've seen that turn around, and we've seen a change in culture, and I don't know if it's how much of that is sort of political stability and finding a way to have our political disagreements make sure that they don't impede on, and some of it is rhetorical, some of it is substantive. You know, I think we have to be cautious and careful about how we have our exchanges, but also how we build a culture that the good work that our state employees do is really respected. And while we may have some political differences, whoever is in charge of whatever agency or branch, or that I'm just curious about your thoughts about what we can do to continue to instill that sense of professionalism and respect so that we keep folks that are not going to make as much as they might in the private sector doing good public work.
Commissioner?
Chairman, Representative Kaline. You know, one thing that struck me, I've been at the Department of Revenue now, it's been 3 years, okay? But the Department of Revenue has done a good job, and I think a lot of it has to do with the legislature and how different administrations have reacted towards the department, of keeping it a very professional, non-political, apolitical organization. You know, we have a very important function over that. It could easily become very political with the, you know, the revenue estimates that we do, how those are scored, but our research wing has maintained its impartiality over many different administrations. If you look up our senior management team, these are all assistant commissioners, and there's really only a couple of political appointees on the whole team. Everybody else are career folks over there who know how to run a revenue agency, and they're revenue administrators. There's guys like me who are political appointees, obviously, and Mr. Salamone, but the majority of the people on our senior management team in all the senior positions are people who've made a career at the Department of Revenue. And I think that brings a sense of stability. You know, we obviously have a point of view of the administration, and that's reflected in our budgets and reflected in the bills that we introduce and advocate for. But as a general rule, we try to keep out of the research element of it or the property tax division. These are people who have served the state of Minnesota and the Department of Revenue, you know, for a long time. And I think that's served really well. There isn't a lot of turnover at the top, other than, you know, the commissioner, deputy commissioner. There's a stability there and a sense of purpose and, you know, institutional memory. And we've tried to do our best to kind of keep that firewall up between the commissioner's office and the research functions. And I think, you know, most accounts, if you talk to the tax chairs and stuff, I think we've succeeded in that area. And I think to a large extent, that's helped the Department of Revenue over time just maintain some of the high-level quality people. They know they don't have to look over behind their back that the next administration is going to clean house and every top-level person is going to be out on the street. There's a sense of continuity within the agency. And just a few of us who get kicked out every 4 or 8 years.
Representative Kaline.
And Mr. Chair and Commissioner Innes, I think that I would say largely kind of on a broad brush impression that I very much agree with your statement. And just another observation that I think the sort of the coreest, most fundamental disagreement between the executive branch and legislature is that, ironically, over the question of revenue. And so I think it is, and it's been a very above board disagreement. I mean, you'll hear a little bit of a twist on it if you haven't already from me and a few others this year, but I think in general, I mean, there's some real honest disagreement that's been above board. And so I think that one of the things that we need to perhaps talk about a little bit more offline, but also as we look forward to a new governor and looking at how do we keep stability in departments regardless of who that is and keep the professional staff happy enough to want to stay and to really feel like their work is respected and trusted. I think it's Madam Chair Khan.
No.
She's just Representative Khan.
Well, I think in I always like to call Representative Hilty Chair Hilty and his committee. So Chair Khan, I think actually that's to the credit of this committee as well, and it's one of the things that we should very much think about being, I mean, I'm not just saying this because I won't be here next year in this chair, but I think that that's a task that we have is to continue to think about what our role is in making and setting the stage for a peaceful and workable transition to the next year and to make sure that as the economy comes back, we have the right people, not just at the helm, but really doing the good work of the professional employees.
Mr. Salamone, if you want to continue with the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we go to the top of page 6, I'd like to quickly run through the status of the integrated tax system that we've mentioned several times. This was a project that was funded by the legislature, both the 2007 legislature and the 2009 legislature. We added some redirection of internal funds from our old systems toward the new project, and there was some small amount of carry-forward money from MMB, the so-called 200 fund. So this project is fully funded, and the funds are committed by contract with a company called Fast Enterprises. Fast Enterprises is a very small company consisting primarily of former tax administrators. They have one line of business, and that's to build and sell their integrated tax system, which, as the commissioner mentioned, is called Gentex. So it's going very well, and on the slide you'll see we completed the first rollout in December of 2008. And that, you'll see on the slide that this, the taxes that were involved in that rollout. So when a rollout is completed, there are a total of four in the entire project. When the rollout's completed, we sort of transitioned into a production mode. So we've completed sales tax, Minnesota care, petroleum taxes, insurance taxes, mortgage and registry, and deed taxes. I've indicated on the slide the number of taxpayers involved in the conversion from the old to the new, and it's pretty striking. So we're very pleased with that uneventful rollout. Rollout 2 on the next slide shows that we have completed the installation of the withholding tax, the corporate franchise tax, the S-Corp tax, fiduciary, partnership, and other business tax, income tax, and the rural electric cooperatives tax, and the dry cleaner tax. Now we're moving into rollout 3. That will be completed at the end of 2010, and that's the big one, the individual income tax. So we sort of cut our teeth on the easier taxes, and now we're moving into the individual income tax. And so far, it looks very good. And then the fourth rollout will be cigarette tax, liquor tax, gambling, and non-tax debt. So we're very pleased with the progress of the project, and don't expect to have any major problems between now and the end of the entire project.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kahn.
Maybe the people who would complain about this don't think to complain to us, which is I should be grateful for. But what about the complaints at any of these rollouts?
Mr. Salamone?
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of any significant complaints from taxpayers. There may be a glitch here and there, but it's been very smooth. And we've been communicating as best we can, both internally and with the taxpayers.
Chairman, Representative Kahn, I would concur with exactly what Commissioner Salamone said. We've been very fortunate so far. The two rollouts have gone out relatively smooth. In fact, we had this fall in December, we did the corporate tax rollout. And I know that economist Tom Stinson actually adjusted the forecast a little bit back in November because he knew about this rollout, and they kind of expected there'd be a little slowdown in collection, slowdown. And the reality was there wasn't. And I think he even spoke to that fact when the forecast came out just this week. That went out without a glitch, and so we were a little more concerned on corporate collections than we otherwise would have been, but it was smooth sailing, essentially.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I obviously moved too slowly to acknowledge him, but I did see at some point sitting next to you the former chair of this committee, my good friend, former Representative Phil Krenke, and perhaps he's the person that we should have been able to ask if there was anything wrong with it. Since he's not in the room anymore, we can't ask him.
And the only thing I would add is that usually we spend a lot of time talking about IT projects that go really badly. Congratulations on having one that didn't.
We still have two rollouts to go. Chairman, back maybe to Representative Kalin's point a little bit. I know that Representative Kahn had an extremely heavy lift to secure the rest of the funding for integrated tax. So, and it's probably not the most glamorous way to spend $20, $30 million of this committee's money. And I know the targets were always challenging over the last few years. But this committee, along with Senator Betzel, found the resources to move forward with this project, knowing that it's just a basic good government thing. It's going to make our tax system, just more efficient and more customer-friendly. So this committee, that was a heavy lift, and I acknowledge that, and we appreciate it. That's why we are committed to not screwing this up.
Okay. Well, no, I think our leadership is, Mr. Chairman, our leadership is about to set targets, so go tell them how much you appreciate the good work we do.
Continue, Mr. Salamone.
Mr. Chair, on page 7, the top of the page 7 is our complete history of compliance initiatives, and there have been a total of six of them. And this is a great summary of the amount of monies appropriated for each one and the expenditures. And as you move across from left to right, you'll see target revenues and actual revenues. Probably the most interesting column on that chart is the final column, the return on investment, which started out at 10 to 1, very significant return. And as you can see, it progressively diminishes as you go down the column. We are currently in the sixth compliance initiative, and as of January 31st of this year, we are estimating that we're going to meet our goal of $41.5 million.
Good.
And that will be a 4-to-1 rate of return. So clearly things, we're in a range of diminishing returns, probably right from the start of the chart. We are continuing, as we'll talk about in a minute, the governor is proposing an additional compliance initiative number 7, and I'll have some data for you on that.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a number of questions around this area. I was a skeptic last year about your ability for returns, and over the last 10, 12 years, I've had the same CPA people come in and see me each year, and so it's always fun to talk to them year to year about issues that they're dealing with in the state. And their visit this time was a little alarming, and I'm looking for some statistical data from your department relative to their concerns. And I'm wondering if you can share with us if you keep like an average collection per case, if you will, and what the trend line on that is. One of the things that they spoke of is they, for at least from their perspective, are fighting you guys in court more often, more aggressively, and they weren't sure whether to attribute it to poorly trained or inadequately trained staff, or they said, you know, just some of the things that the department is fighting them on. They have a number of people in a large firm that are both CPAs and attorneys, and a growing feeling, at least, and then, in fact, I had people from three different firms in my office that day, a growing feeling that you guys are getting, you know, you're going for the quarters and the cushions, you know, and the couch, and stretching what may be either long-held practices or interpretations of taxation and whether or not something's taxable or not, et cetera. So I'm just wondering, you know, this is a nice little chart, but you're asking us, at least me, through a leap of faith to look at another compliance number. And I'm just wondering, given what I'm hearing out on the street, if we have kind of reached the end of the rope, so to say, on this ability to put in, you know, $10 million and book $30 million.
Commissioner?
Chairman, Representative Holberg, maybe I'll preface my comments by saying, you know, we were sitting down with the governor trying to resolve a $1.2 billion budget puzzle. And this wasn't our first option, our second option, or our 27th option. And we were confronted with a lot of less than optimum options at our disposal. And so when we got towards the end of trying to solve this budget puzzle, this was one of the last things that the governor actually said, okay, can we do one more increment? And I guess there's two questions. I'm thinking of what your comments were. The one question is, can you actually generate the ROI that we say we can generate? Can you generate a 4-to-1 ROI? My response to that is that I'm fairly confident that we can generate the 4-to-1 ROI. The second question, it's also a public policy question, the question you guys have to wrestle with, is the extra juice worth the squeeze? Is the squeeze worth the juice, I guess? You know, because I'll be the first to acknowledge that these compliance initiatives, if you roll back the tape to the Ventura administration when they did the first compliance initiative of this nature, I think everybody around the table was under the impression this is kind of a one, maybe two time sort of stopgap measure in order to solve a budget deficit. I don't think anybody foresaw the extent of the, you know, economy going down and the budgetary challenge we're having, and that these would become kind of a permanent feature of our tax landscape. We constantly come back to this committee and ask for another compliance initiative in order to solve the last increment. So in an ideal world, we would not be here advocating or even asking for another compliance issue. We understand that. It's not the healthiest thing even for the organization because we're constantly in hyper-compliance mode, training mode, trying to get auditors up to speed so they can do a competent job. So you couple the fact that we've been in what I would say a hyper-compliance mode for a number of years, as you know, Representative, and then you overlay that, the worst economic crisis since World War II, where businesses are already struggling, and then we show up at their door. And I totally is mindful of that. And so the question becomes, has the tipping point been reached? You know, I think we can generate the ROI. If we're asked to do another net of $20 million, I think we can get there. The question that we all have to wrestle with and talk about is exactly what you talk about. I mean, have we saturated the economy with auditors and tax compliance? Have we, you know, do we need to pull back? We think this was a less worse option than some of the other options we had as far as resolving the budget. And, you know, we're open to discussions about it. I did tell Senator Betzel yesterday in front of the committee that we think what is in the governor's budget really is the stretch goal, and anything above and beyond that would be probably not even doable from the department standpoint. Especially, you know, remember, this is in the context of a one-year compliance initiative. In the past, the compliance initiatives have been the beginning of a biennium, and we've gotten 2 years. So we have time to train people and get them out in the field. These one-year ones are extremely difficult because we say this bill passes in May. We start hiring in June, and we train, do all the adequate training. That's months of training. You know, you get people out in the field, you only have 6 months of kind of audit generation. So these one-year compliance initiatives are uniquely challenging beyond all the other noise that's out there in the economy. And so we can get back to you on more some more data about what we're generating per audit, where we've seen a diminished returns. The question about litigation, I think that's probably an accurate assessment. We have seen our litigation docket and the amount of appeals probably gone up somewhat. How much can you tease out how much that is just pure the economy and people are stalling and don't have the money to pay, so they're going to appeal, or it's just more a function of more audits? We're clearly doing more audits. We have more auditors in the field. We've also heard anecdotally that taxpayers are being told, you know, the Department of Revenue has a lot on their plate right now. You might be able to strike a better compromise or deal if you take the next step of litigating or going to administrative appeals. So it's a lot. There's a lot going on, and it's an economically difficult time. So taxpayers are under particular strain. You know, to the point on the taxpayer advocate's office, we've added a taxpayer advocate to that office in the last year, maybe a year and a half ago we did, because we saw an uptick in the amount of people who needed assistance from that independent taxpayer advocate office. So it's a tough time. It's a tough time for tax administrators. It's a tough time for businesses. We've seen instances where field auditors go out and make requests for information from taxpayers, and basically it's, you know, no response, unresponsive. So even the auditors are having challenging times about even, you know, scheduling meetings with taxpayers. So it is, I'll just say, it's challenging out there.
Well, and I mean, to that point, I'm looking for some statistical analysis of, I mean, I know what my gut's telling me. I know as a business owner that went through a sales tax audit, I mean, we got to a certain point where I could have kept fighting, but it was like, just pay up, just end this. Like, you know, I got it to a point where it was easier to pay rather than to keep fighting. So in this economy, businesses may have more time to fight, you know, because they're not as busy or whatever. So I mean, I'm just really curious. There's got to be some trends over this now nearly 10-year period of time to really determine whether or not this is even feasible, and that, I mean, it sure would not be a good thing for you to go out and hire a bunch of new auditors and fall flat on your return on investment and make the situation worse within your department. We don't want that to happen either, because then we're just going to be dealing with laying people off right after we hire them, moving into the next budget cycle. So any trend lines, averages, anything that you can provide, I'd be really happy to see.
Chairman, Representative Holberg, we'll provide that, and if there's gaps in the data, please let us know, and we'll do our best to fill those gaps. You know, we have seen, you know, people We have an administrative appeals process in the department. So anybody who has an audit assessment done, they can go to this low-cost, no-cost administrative appeals process, have a second set of eyes, look at the audit. That administrative appeals process still is fairly effective at resolving disputes. 95%+ get resolved at that level. Only less than 5% actually go to tax court and get litigated. So I think that is still doing a pretty good job, but we're seeing an uptick across the board. You know, we are absolutely representative of seeing an uptick. And it's putting a strain on the department, and I know it's putting, more importantly, it's putting a strain on taxpayers.
Representative Fountain.
Yes, well, Mr. Chairman, from years of having contested on various issues, Representative Holberg, I guess if you got a process that got her to give in, I think that ought to be patented and just used throughout the state.
Madam Chair, I hate Holberg. To disappoint you, but it had a lot to do with my husband saying a few choice words and say, just give him the blankety-blank mommy and tell him to go away. So the secret weapon may reside within my own household, unavailable to the legislature.
Tactic I never thought of using, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, I think this
I represent Kaelin. I think Representative Mason was up next.
I was just going to suggest. I was just going to announce that the speaker has appointed Mr. Holberg to every conference committee that.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whoever would like to answer, just kind of following on what Representative Holberg was saying. I mean, when you're auditing a small business. That's huge. I mean, the owner's going away, not to mention he said that, you know, they have to bring in their bookkeepers, auditor, you know, whoever does their financial papers. And in some cases, what I'm told is, you know, their audits came out pretty clean or whatever it is, and yet it seemed like you're on top of them again. So is, like, every time there's an initiative, are you using the same people over again, or is it a different base?
Commissioner.
Chairman, Representative Mason, ideally it's supposed to be a different base. I mean, if we're going out and conducting what is essentially what you described, a no change audit, it is not a good use of our resources or the taxpayers' time and resources to be out there in a short period of time again auditing that taxpayer. The reality is, though, I have been notified there's been a little bit of an uptick in what I would call no change audits. And so we need to do a better job at the department of identifying the audits that are going to be higher yield. Also, if someone is relatively in compliance, which is pretty good by tax standards, we shouldn't be out there in another year or another, in close proximity. I think what happens oftentimes, though, is that when we send an auditor out, they don't cover all the tax types. They are specialists in their area. So it's a sales tax audit, provider tax audit, an income tax audit. So what sometimes when I dig in behind those inquiries about another audit, it's usually a different tax type audit. And but maybe we can come to the realization as well, is that if you're in high end compliance in the sales tax area, you're probably doing a pretty good job on the other tax types too. You know, you can kind of extrapolate that one, if you're in compliance in one area, you're probably going to be in compliance in other areas. So I will say this, Representative, we are going to do everything we can to do a better job at selecting the audits. And if there's no change audits out there, we should probably leave that taxpayer alone for a while. Right.
For your benefit, I guess, my company had the benefit. I can't even remember what type, but we went through a tax audit this past fall. And the person that was sent over was very easy to deal with, professional, and it took, maybe 30 minutes out of our bookkeeper's day in order to get it done. And so in not all cases is it painful. Process to go through, and I think anytime you're getting a 4-to-1 ROI, that seems to be some indicator that there's still fruit on the vine that you're plucking, because I don't think we often get that kind of ROI in any kind of expenditure that we make in state government. So that to me would be the other side of it. Continue.
Mr. Chair, at the bottom of that page, there is a summary of a law that was passed in 2009, which we call the Data Match Program. This law gave the department the authority to engage financial institutions in comparing records and being able to get assessments from with the help of financial institutions. Terry Steenblok, our collections director, is joining me, and she can answer any questions you may have about that program. You can see quickly from the slide that it's been very successful, and as far as I know, it has not been a problem for at least for the department. I'm not sure about the taxpayers.
I don't see any questions from the committee.
Well, I guess one.
Representative Khan. I shouldn't have said that.
Mr. Chairman, the does that mean is there something more than could be done in that area?
Ms. Steenblatt?
Is that, you know, like compliance? If you do 10 to 1, should we make you do 20 to 1?
It actually has been, I will say, to the benefit of the financial institutions. One of the reasons why this was successful was because we did bring in the financial institutions to talk about how we could do this, where it wasn't an impact to them, and we were able to be successful with this. And what we have found, when we did this, we implemented the same process as the Department of Human Services, so there was no change for the financial institutions. And what we did find was a greater sense of compliance when we did these. When we started doing the matches, we did receive phone calls from individuals who owed debt that didn't realize we were able to get that information. And they were debtors that had evaded us for quite some time. As you notice, the 3,787 number there, those were debts that we had referred out to a private collection agency. And what that means is we exhausted all of our collection actions and we referred it out to a private collection agency. It came back to us because they were unsuccessful, so we referred it out to another private collection agency. We like to do everything we can before we look at charging off a debt. When we instituted the financial institution data match, we were able to successfully collect these debts because we did find additional financial information. So we'll continue down that path and hopefully continue to bring in a better return on investment on this than we already have. We're less than a year into it, so we're optimistic that it will continue to be successful.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Khan.
I'm not sure I quite got an answer to my question. The answer to the question was if we put more resources in this, could we expect a greater return on it?
Ms. Steenbach.
The answer to that would be no, because with this particular process, it's pretty automated, and we don't need the people intervention there. However, we'll continue to look for other opportunities and tools.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, maybe this is for Mr. Salamone. Do you have any information in the last few years for undercollected taxes? Like in the last fiscal year, it seems like in past years it's been close to $850 million or something. I'm just wondering, talk a lot about percentages and things. I'm just wondering where we're at right now in dollar amounts, if we have any information on that.
Mr. Chair, as far as delinquent outstanding accounts receivable, our net amount right now is roughly $300 million.
That's better.
I have a question. Can you sell any of that debt?
That's an interesting question. We actually did look into that a couple of years ago, looked at the possibility. A lot of the private industry sells their accounts receivable, and we looked at, in lieu of charging off debts, would it be possible for us to sell those to some companies? And there's a variety of different factors that we have to take into consideration. Some of that outstanding accounts receivable is result of commissioner-filed returns. And at any time, a taxpayer can come back and file their return. And so a lot of private agencies aren't interested in purchasing that from us because the taxpayer can file their own return, and they run the risk of losing money. There's also other things that we took into consideration. We want to make sure that the taxpayer does have all their rights met. If they do appeal, they have those opportunities. And there was some concerns if we sold that, we may be missing out on some of that opportunity as well. We also looked at the cost that private agencies were willing to pay because we have so much more tools at our discretion, and our debts are very thoroughly worked when we collect them, and their interest in purchasing that was at a very low rate of return for us.
So the conclusion is it's not a very good fit.
Right. I'm sorry. Yes.
That's okay.
Yes.
Representative Kaitlin.
And I wonder, Mr. Chair and Ms. Steenblatt, whether there are some statutory changes that could reduce that risk and to make it a better fit.
Reduce
the risk for the potential purchaser, you know, essentially in marketing bonds, the return is based on the rate is based on the risk that the bond purchaser has, and that's essentially what would happen here. And wondering if there's something that we could do to, and just saying, sort of innovative ways that would still preserve rights, or maybe even minimize, maybe cut away those rights, but stay within reasonable policy framework where we could sell some of that $300 million.
Mr. Chair, one of the things that we have looked at and we would be consider looking at again would be the statute of limitations. That's one of the factors that prevents us from selling debt as well. You can only collect it within a certain time frame, and if we sell that debt, that impacts the statute of limitations. So we would want to look at the possibility of allowing, if we sell that debt, allowing the statute of limitations to carry over to that private company, possibly extending the statute of limitations. One of the other things you run into is there's a variable statute of limitations depending upon the debt within the agencies, because we collect for other state agencies as well. So in a study that we had done a few years ago, one of the things that we had recommended was looking at making a consistent statute of limitations across all debt types, and that's something that we could look at again and consider.
Ms. Steenblatt, I think the committee would be interested in at least looking at what that might be. Representative Kahn, we are over time.
I know.
allow you any further questions.
I know. It's nice to see you run such a tight ship. But I'm interested in this 678 number. Are there financial institutions that aren't participating in this?
At this time, Mr. Chair, at this time, when we started this process, we did get a list of all financial institutions, and at this time, we have one financial institution that we're having some difficulty with and we're working with.
Okay.
Mr. Salamone, we didn't get all the way through your presentation, and it looks like people are beginning to filter into the room. Perhaps, I know that we have a testifier who wanted to speak and may be willing to come back. Maybe we could just finish up the last point of the discussion at another time and have the testifier respond as well.
Mr. Chair, everything I would have said is on the slide. I think it's pretty much self-explanatory. It's the governor's recommendation, supplemental budget.
All right. Thank you, and we're adjourned.